Taub joining us from Amman. Also, thanks to journalist and commentator Breck Yonkers joining us from Hasselt. And also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا مِنْهُ إِنَّهُ لَيَئُوسٌ كَفُورٌ وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
For headlines, India's total coronavirus cases surpassed the 20 million mark amid a severe shortage of medical supplies in overwhelmed hospitals. Black Lives Matter activists call for an end to racism in the U.S. during a funeral for a black man killed by a white officer. Also, fresh protests erupt in Colombia after 19 people died in violent demonstrations against a proposed government tax reform. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, India's total COVID-19 infections have soared past 20 million after it reported more than 357,000 new cases in the past 24 hours. India's caseload is the second largest in the world after the U.S. The Asian country's total COVID deaths are above 222,000. Meanwhile, Indian opposition leader Rahul Gandhi called for a nationwide lockdown amid the surge in the disease. He said the government's inaction is killing many innocent people. Coronavirus has peaked in India in the past few weeks, causing a health crisis there. The country is now facing severe shortages of medicines and oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been overstretched by the virus outbreak. The surge has been blamed on large political and religious gatherings, as well as people's reluctance to wear masks. To get more information on the COVID crisis in India, I'm now joined by Manavar Zaman, our correspondent in New Delhi. Manavar, thank you for joining us. Hope you're safe. Manavar, tell us more about the crisis in India, about the latest figures. Are the figures showing any sign of going down?
Thank you once again. Well, since yesterday, we are getting some good news as the figures are showing a slight respite. Not too much, but yes, a slight respite. And the death toll has decreased a little bit. There is a change in trending since yesterday, as I have been closely monitoring the situation. Well, but we cannot trust that figure as well, because there are underreported cases. Many patients are dying at homes because they don't report to the hospitals, because there is no space in the hospitals. But yes, if we look at the government figures, if you look at the data that the health ministry has released since yesterday, we see a very good sign of respite. And we might expect that today. We're waiting for the latest data this evening, and it is believed that today's data will be the highest in all the weeks that we have reported. So we have to wait till evening, but today's trends are pretty good. But at the same time, the oxygen supplies continue to be short. People are still gasping with the lack of oxygen supplies in the hospitals, especially if we talk about the capital, New Delhi. The Delhi's chief minister has asked the central government to help us with the army. They are asking the central government, let the army take care of the COVID care centers, because it is getting out of control now, because yesterday, New Delhi recorded a highest number of death toll at around 400, and many cases are going unreported because there's a lot of queues outside the crematoriums. And there are not just people who die in the hospitals. There are many people who die in home quarantine, and they are not being registered in the government data. So we cannot trust the data completely that the government is giving us. So we just have to wait for proper data tonight. If the government comes with latest figures, then I've spoken with many experts either. They're saying that the government's failure also to avoid the crisis is one of the biggest problems that this country is facing, because many scientists in the month of January has warned the Indian government that the second wave would be disastrous and it would be much dangerous than the first wave. But the report said the government has ignored those scientists as well. Back to you.
Manavar, many morgues and crematoriums have been overwhelmed with masses of COVID deaths. Any updates on that?
Well, we are talking about crematoriums just in New Delhi. That's where I'm based at. But the state of Uttar Pradesh, Maharashtra, and Madhya Pradesh, these are the largest populated states. They are making a makeshift crematoriums, because you wouldn't believe the fact that in New Delhi, there are certain crematoriums just in the adjoining areas where I am. And I have spoken with the manager there. He would tell me that in the normal days, we would burn 3 or 4 bodies, a maximum 5 bodies. Those were natural deaths. But right now, we are overwhelmed, as more than 100 and 130 people are queuing up outside the crematoriums, and they have to wait for long hours, probably 4 hours or 5 hours. And this process doesn't continue just for a day. It continues for day and night, 24 hours. Now the government has made some makeshift crematoriums, and they are being prepared to cater or to burn the bodies of people who doesn't get proper cremation. So it's a very grim situation. And today's day and tomorrow's day is going to decide what next India will see. But many believe that India would register 500,000 cases by next week.
Right.
And yesterday I was reading some studies that the scientists have warned Indian government a few months ago that India might see a rise in cases, daily cases, as much as 1 million per day in the middle of the May. Back to you.
Manavar, I have one last question for you before I let you go. Well, many believe that a sluggish vaccination campaign has compounded the crisis. Now, how's the vaccination is going right now? What's the status there?
Vaccination is something which India was the largest producer. And as I said, in many bulletins that India was extremely overconfident in the month of October 2020 when it thought that the virus was somehow retreating. And the country started opening up its markets, and religious gatherings were thrown up, and many other sectors were thrown up. And the vaccination that it had already in the stock, that was not complete vaccine that it needed for the population India has. But till now, India has vaccinated only 9% of its population, and that was the first shot. And many of people are still to receive the second shot. But the country, there was also a problem with the vaccination costing when the country's central government said that different states will have a different costings on the vaccines. For example, the neighboring Uttar Pradesh will have vaccine shot at 600 Indian rupees, but in other state it will be 400 rupees. So there were a lot of debates and a lot of issues with the vaccination costing, the delivery system, the management, of course, and at the later stage, the Supreme Court had to intervene, asking the central government to make the vaccination a universalized model. Not have different costs in different states, and make sure that the vaccine drive starts. But now they're running short of vaccination stockpiles because they exported many when they thought that the virus is retreating. Now they don't have their stock. But now the vaccination company Pfizer is exporting some 70 million worth of vaccine doses. We're waiting for it. Let's see what happens.
Thank you so much, Munawar, for joining us. That was Munawar Zaman, our correspondent in New Delhi, joining us via Skype. Now, moving on, American civil rights activist Al Sharpton has called for an end to racism in the country, urging lawmakers to take action to stop racial profiling.
This must stop. Enough is enough. How many funerals do we have to have before we tell the Congress and the Senate that you've got to do something in these times?
Sharpton was addressing people taking part in the funeral ceremony of Andrew Brown, an African-American killed by police. Sharpton called on law enforcement officials to release the whole tape of the police encounter with Brown. 42-year-old Brown was fatally shot during a morning raid at his home on April the 21st, when local sheriff's deputies tried to serve him with search and arrest warrants. His killing in mysterious circumstances has captured national attention. The United States has been the scene of mass anti-racism protests following the death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a white officer last year. Former U.S. federal officer Matthew Fogg says the growing anti-police sentiment in the U.S. could bring change concerning how killing of African Americans is handled.
But again, I think today we've seen something we've never seen before. The fact that I think we have the pandemic and more people had time to come out to watch these things, to see videos, to get out, to get involved, I think it has changed the sentiment of the country. I think you will see other officers get convicted, but the bottom line is, you know, it's very tough to do that in the United States. But now that the sentiment is changing and that everybody seems to now beginning to put this thing on the front burner, we've got the video cameras that are now really the game changers, so to speak. So I think what you're going to start seeing is more convictions, or more people will start to just, you know, plead out. But the bottom line is there's a change taking place. Now, we've got the George Floyd Protection Act in Congress that was passed through the House of Representatives. It's going to be a little battle in the Senate, but it's a chance that bill is going to get passed, and that's going to bring a whole lot more accountability and transparency to law enforcement. So I can see changes coming.
New protests have been held in Colombia's capital, Bogota, after deadly demonstrations against a proposed government tax reform. Protesters marched in Bogota despite military presence. Truck drivers also blocked access roads to several locations in Colombia to protest the government's economic policies. Colombia has witnessed protests against the government's proposed tax reform for a week now. The rallies have continued even after the government withdrew its plan on Sunday. Anger has also boiled over the killing of 19 people and clashes with security forces during the protests. Hundreds more were injured in the clashes. Colombia is grappling with an economic crisis amid the pandemic. The European Union's foreign policy chief has stressed the need to seize the opportunity to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Josep Borrell said he has highlighted the importance of the U.S. return to the deal and its full implementation during the first ministerial meeting of the G7. The remaining signatories to the deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to find ways to salvage the nuclear accord. While substantial progress has been made in the talks, diplomats say differences still persist. Iran says it will return to full compliance with the deal only after all U.S. sanctions against Iran are removed in a verifiable manner. Iran has once again reiterated that the U.S. should remove all sanctions it imposed, reimposed, or relabeled after leaving the 2015 nuclear deal before the Islamic Republic accepts results of the ongoing talks in Vienna. Salman Khoury reports.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Blockaded Gaza Strip have marked World Press Freedom Day. The international occasion is very important for Palestinian journalists who often get attacked by Israeli soldiers in a clear violation of their right to cover the news. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past 2 decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including 4 under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last 3 wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
That's your board news for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger, and I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which
is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Contrary to what pundits in the West want you to believe, all shades of political opinion in Iran bear their allegiance to the Islamic Revolution and agree that the movement needs to be preserved and the ideals of revolution need to be incorporated into governance and rule of law. Here we present you an article in this regard written by Sayed Zafar Mehdi, a Tehran-based journalist with over 10 years of experience, who has reported extensively for leading publications worldwide on the topic of Iran's School of Resistance. Please stay with us for more on the topic. While anti-colonial movements post-Second World War succeeded in overthrowing the repressive ruling structures in many parts of the world, in the Third World, there was a transition from colonialism to neocolonialism. The Islamic Revolution of Iran changed that by confronting the exploitative powers and freeing the country from the domination of the West. The revolution, which had a ripple effect across the Muslim world, marked a watershed moment in the never-ending fight against the Western imperialism and allowed the newly formed Islamic Republic to assert its sovereignty and establish social justice based on sacrosanct Islamic values and beliefs. While the revolution shored up resistance against the U.S. in Iran, it also inspired anti-Western movements across the region that valiantly stood up to imperialistic domination. What made this revolution different was its Islamic ideological precepts, motto of freedom, and emphasis on the ideals of Karbala Uprising, which was held by the leadership of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Referring to the Islamic revival across the world, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, the founder of the Islamic Republic, said then, "The Iranian people's revolution is only a point in the start of the revolution of the great world of Islam." 4 decades on, his words still resonate, the effects of which can be felt in the region and beyond, unceasingly inspiring the campaigners of truth and justice. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had proposed a model of governance based on social welfare and freedom. He also laid the foundation of a force that would not only defend the country but also the revolution. That is how the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, came into being in April 1979, first as a volunteer force comprising youth that secured neighborhoods from Pahlavi regime's marauding troops, and later it evolved into a full-fledged institution. Article 150 of the country's constitution states the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, organized in the early days of the triumph of the revolution, is to be maintained so that it may continue in its role of the guarding the revolution and its achievements. From General Mohsen Rezai, who led the Corps for about 16 years between 1980s and 1990s, to Major General Hossein Salami, the present-day chief, the IRGC has played its role commendably in preserving the ideals of 1979 revolution. However, the biggest accomplishment has been its no-holds-barred resistance to America's hegemonic ambitions and destabilizing activities in the region, which was the basic goal of the revolution. In the last four decades, many governments have assumed power in Tehran, each following their own domestic, regional, and international policies in the true spirit of a vibrant democracy. At times, pressure tactics were used to bring Tehran to its knees. However, Iran survived all waves of hostility and aggression and came out stronger. Amidst these political upheavals, the role of IRGC, particularly its Quds force, has been noteworthy. It has ensured that the Islamic Republic's foreign policy continues to be in tune with what was envisioned by a founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. This is where the role of former Quds force commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, deserves a mention. Understanding the broader ideology of Islamic revolution and the principles of resistance is essential to comprehend Iran's advisory presence in the region, especially in places where the U.S. and its notorious allies have been carrying out their destabilizing activities. One can refer to his role in eliminating the Zionist threat in southern Lebanon, annihilating Daesh Takfiri terrorists from Syria and Iraq, and strengthening the resistance front in Palestine. As President Hassan Rouhani remarked recently, he stood tall in both the battlefield and in diplomacy. Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated along with his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, the deputy head of the Popular Mobilization Units, and their companions in a U.S. terror drone strike authorized by former U.S. President Donald Trump near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Iran pursues an independent foreign policy and believes in fostering deep ties with countries across the globe. It also does not shy away from protecting its sovereignty and territorial integrity and those of its neighbors and regional allies. That's what Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, meant by Islamic governance, which goes beyond lip service and forms the basis of the country's constitution. Contrary to what pundits in the West want you to believe, all shades of political opinion in Iran bear their allegiance to the Islamic Revolution and agree that the movement needs to be preserved and the ideals of the revolution need to be incorporated into governance and rule of law. Since this revolution does not approve meddling of foreign powers in the country's domestic affairs and calls for resistance against the forces of global hegemony, the United States and its allies understandably have a problem with it. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said on February 2019, on the 40th anniversary of the revolution, the Islamic Revolution has never suffered from and will never suffer from stagnation and recession. He noted that the world today is witnessing an Islamic awakening based on the model of resistance to American and Zionist dominance, and that the U.S. and its allies have failed while Iran has thrived. This has been possible due to the efforts of those who have guarded this revolution with their pure blood. This has been possible due to adherence to the lofty ideals of the Islamic Revolution.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
10 minutes. In late April, world powers resumed high-level talks in Vienna. Currently, the Americans are not at the table because they unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018 under then-President Donald Trump, who restored and increased sanctions in a campaign of maximum pressure in a bid to force Iran into renegotiating the pact with more concessions. The Biden administration has now shown interest in reviving the Iran nuclear deal, but the road to come back seems too bumpy. The Vienna talks kickstarted in early April. There have been several rounds of high-level discussions, while expert groups have been working on proposals on how to resolve the issues around American sanctions and Iranian compliance. On April 21st, the U.S. provided Iran with an outline of the sanctions it was prepared to remove as part of a mutual return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. According to a senior State Department official, there still are disagreements, and in some cases pretty important ones, on our respective views about what is required to, what is meant by a return to full compliance. And the distance that remains to be travelled is greater than the distance that we've travelled so far. So we're not near the conclusion of these negotiations. The outcome is still uncertain. While there have been reports of progress made in Vienna, by the looks of things, it is hard to see enough progress made to change the picture dramatically from the deadlock lingering on since 2018. In fact, the only progress is that the two sides, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States, have agreed to come into compliance if the other side agrees to their conditions. And here lie the roots of all the complications at the Vienna talks.
These talks have been described as constructive, as businesslike, as accomplishing what they set out to do. And that is true. We would characterize it that way as well. We would also, however, hasten to not allow expectations to outpace where we are. After all, we have said this will be hard.
Unlike the previous rounds of talks, the United States has detailed this time its sanctions on Iran by breaking them down into three main categories. Nuclear-related sanctions the U.S. must remove to return to full compliance, non-nuclear sanctions the U.S. does not need to remove, and sanctions imposed by the Trump administration under a non-nuclear pretext. The problem is, the Biden administration considers some of the sanctions imposed on Iran by the Trump administration as legitimate and in line with the Iran nuclear deal, so they would not be lifted. These sanctions had to do with Iran's missile and cyber programs, or have been imposed under human rights-related excuses. To complicate matters further, the main bulk of these sanctions have been passed by the U.S. Congress, and according to the nuclear deal, the Congress can grant or renew 120-day or 180-day waivers on the sanctions. Needless to say, the renewals are only on condition of verification. In other words, the U.S. must acknowledge every now and then whether or not the Islamic Republic is in compliance with the deal before offering any sanction relief. And that's not what Iran is looking for. Since the beginning of the new talks in Vienna, Tehran has been seeking to build a consensus around its proposed endgame scheme, warning other parties that only a limited time remains to narrow the gaps.
The new initiative put forward by the Iranians to break the deadlock is in stark contrast to what the Americans are going to do with the sanctions. Iran argues that all the sanctions imposed under the Trump administration violate the JCPOA and has so far called on Washington to lift the roughly 1,500 sanctions imposed by Biden's predecessor. The Biden administration, however, has made it clear that's a non-starter. Contrary to Tehran's demand, the Americans persist in keeping the sanctions imposed over the past 4 years under the rubric of non-nuclear sanctions. Moreover, according to the recent briefing with senior State Department official on recent U.S. engagement in Vienna regarding the JCPOA, Washington is still looking for a broader deal. One of the most significant parts of the brief says, "Our view remains that if we can come back into a mutual compliance with the JCPOA, we do that, as the president has said many times, as a platform from which we would like to discuss a longer, stronger, broader set of understandings with Iran."
When the Trump administration left the agreement and the sanctions came back, the damage to Iran's economy was quite severe. Billions of dollars were deprived from the Iranian people. And it was the Trump administration that broke the deal. And the least the U.S. government, the current government, can do is to say that they're willing to go back to the nuclear agreement. And they speak in a way that gives us an impression that they are not going to do that, because they talk about this idea of longer and stronger.
It seems that the United States plans to keep at least part of the sanctions as a negotiating leverage against Iran, with the ultimate goal of coercing Tehran into accepting a comprehensive deal over different issues, including its defense program, as well as its role in the region. Reading the Americans' intention, the Islamic Republic insists on the lifting of all sanctions as a precondition of talks with Washington, as the only way to avoid negotiations of attrition. The important thing for Iran is to benefit, especially financially, from a deal which would restrict its peaceful nuclear program. Otherwise, there is no reason for Tehran to do that, and the U.S. sanctions are acting as a stumbling block to this purpose. Washington's latest proposals over lifting sanctions mean that Iran might sell its oil with less restrictions, while it will have more problems in banking interactions with the world. With more than 500 individuals and institutes on the SDN list, or specially designated nationals and blocked persons list, trade and bank interactions with Iran might be more risky than the time before the Iran nuclear deal was signed. And the violators, in the eyes of Washington, might face severe punishment. By the same token, 120-day or 180-day waivers would act like the sword of Damocles. And since there is no guarantee for the renewal of the waivers, the stakes would be high for international investors to invest in Iran. After Trump decided to withdraw from the nuclear deal overnight and reimpose sanctions on Iran, it seems very unlikely that foreign investors sign long-term agreements with Iran, as they cannot count on the Americans' promises whatsoever. In other words, under the current circumstances, Iran would not benefit from the deal. The fact is, the JCPOA, in its current form, shows once more the falsity of a bad deal is better than no deal fallacy. Perhaps it's time to say that no deal is better than a bad deal. Will it be Iran's real endgame scheme? We have to wait and see.
In the limelight.
For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium, dioxin, and VX nerveagent, says John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tim Sharrock, writer. This article is published under the heading Toxic Legacy of U.S. Military in Pacific. Stay tuned for more. John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times, has spent years documenting the Pentagon's brazen use of the Pacific as a testing site and dumping ground for dangerous weapons. Wherever the United States military goes, it contaminates and damages the environment and human health, he says. He warns that the proposed U.S. military expansion in the Asia-Pacific, its largest since the Vietnam War, will aggravate an environmental disaster caused by 75 years of American wars and intervention. The Pacific Islands have been militarized since the Second World War by the American military and are now the edge of the American Empire, he said. They suffered in the past and will inevitably suffer in the future. Mitchell's recent book, Poisoning the Pacific, the U.S. Military's Secret Dumping of Plutonium, Chemical Weapons, and Agent Orange, explores this largely unknown legacy. Based on hundreds of declassified U.S. documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and interviews with U.S. veterans and whistleblowers, it documents the Pentagon's use, testing, and storage of chemical, nuclear, and other weapons of mass destruction, WMD, in the Pacific, and the disastrous impact of its flawed handling and storage of such weapons. For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium, dioxin, and VX nerveagent, Mitchell explains in his introduction. Hundreds of thousands of service members, their families, and residents have been exposed, but the United States has hidden the damage and refused to help victims, he added. The dangerous lurch toward military confrontation in Asia underscores Mitchell's concerns. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command recently unveiled to Congress that it is seeking $27 billion in additional spending to station additional troops and weapons to counter what it claims is a growing military threat from China. The plans, which also draw on $4.6 billion appropriated by Congress for its Pacific Deterrence Initiative, include a precision strike missile network on the island chain running from Okinawa to the Philippines, the first U.S. Marine base in the Pacific since the Korean War, a missile defense system on Guam, and a radar system on Palau in the Marshall Islands. The Pentagon is also seeking funds to reorganize the 27,000 Marines based in the Pacific region into small units into Guam, Japan, and Hawaii that can operate inside the range of Chinese rockets. The harm that could follow from this expansion can be seen in Okinawa, the focus of much of Mitchell's book. It houses 70% of the total number of U.S. bases in Japan, where 50,000 American troops make up the Pentagon's largest overseas contingent. Through his tenacious reporting, Mitchell has uncovered story after story about the use and misuse of WMDs on the island prefecture, which was occupied by the U.S. military after the bloody battle for Okinawa in 1945 and handed back to Japan in 1972. In 2011, Mitchell was the first reporter to interview U.S. Air Force technicians on Okinawa, in charge of the storage of nuclear weapons, which included over 1,200 warheads at Kadena and Naha Air Force bases, as well as at U.S. Army ammunition dumps in Chibana and Henoko. He also broke stories about the U.S. testing of biological weapons and its storage and transshipment of Agent Orange, the defoliant used over Vietnam and Okinawa. His reporting extends beyond the Cold War. Mitchell uncovered the U.S. military's accidental use of depleted uranium rounds at an Okinawan live fire range in 1995 and 1996, its dump of radioactive waste into sewers beneath U.S. bases in mainland Japan in 2011, and hundreds of recent environmental accidents at U.S. bases on Okinawa that were not reported to Japanese authorities. His book also describes years of high decibel noise pollution from the American jets flying near residential areas in Okinawa. Such long-term exposure is a serious health risk that can cause heart problems, disrupt sleep patterns, and damage cognitive skills in children. One Japanese university study estimated that noise from Kadena was responsible for an average of 10 deaths a year, with 17,000 people suffering from disrupted sleep. The U.S. military presence on Okinawa is an environmental justice problem. That's what the American people must understand, Mitchell said. Earlier this month, the importance of U.S. bases to America's Pacific strategy was underscored when Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga was the first foreign leader to meet with President Joe Biden at the White House. In a joint statement, the two leaders affirmed their ironclad support for the U.S.-Japan military alliance and agreed that Japan would complete construction of a new U.S. Marine Air Base at Henoko in northern Okinawa as the only solution to replace the unpopular Futenma facility. But as Mitchell points out, the U.S. military is building the Henoko base, the scene of daily demonstrations upon a pristine coral reef. Their environment has been decimated by the American military, he said. The Pentagon, through U.S. Forces Japan, denies most of Mitchell's claims. The statement that the U.S. does not clean up contaminants is simply false, a U.S. FJ public affairs officer wrote in a lengthy email. The GOJ, that is, the government of Japan, has never indicated to the U.S. in any bilateral forum that the Okinawan environment has been decimated. The American response to environmental spills is some of the most aggressive in the world, the PA officer added. The health and safety of everyone in and around U.S. installations is one of our top priorities, and we take matters of environmental stewardship very seriously. Mitchell has also reported extensively on water pollution on U.S. bases. During 1960s, he said the water near Kadena was so contaminated that it literally could be set on fire. In his book, he documents 650 environmental incidents between 1998 and 2016 at Kadena, largely caused by leaks of fuel and firefighting foam. These incidents have ranged from small fuel leaks of only several liters that stayed on the base to large spills discharging tens of thousands of liters of fuel and raw sewage into local rivers, he writes. Military incompetence has repeatedly endangered local water. More recently, Mitchell documented severe water contamination in drinking wells around Yokota Air Base, the headquarters of U.S. Forces Japan, near Tokyo, where American presidents and other senior U.S. officials land when they visit Japan. In 2000, officials from the Tokyo Metropolitan Government found no evidence the pollutants came from inside the base. But Mitchell argues that Japanese government reports carry little weight because its officials are prohibited from entering U.S. bases to carry out inspections. The problem, he contends, is the U.S.-Japan Status of Forces Agreement signed in 1960. Thanks to this agreement, the American military does not need to clean up contaminated land, he said. They do not need to allow Japanese officials to inspect the bases. In contrast, in the United States, you can go to EPA webpages and find out what bases are contaminated with what. Asked about the SOFA clause that prevents Japanese officials from inspecting U.S. bases, USFJ responded with a qualifier. While the basic language of SOFA has not changed since its inspection, it said both of the U.S. and Japanese governments agree that the agreement works well to serve the interests of the two countries. In the in concluded, the commander of U.S. Forces Japan is designated as DOD lead environmental component for Japan and therefore will ensure U.S. military operations are carried out in a responsible manner that will protect the environment now and for future generations. Statesmen like that, along with the lack of U.S. press coverage, reflect the disdain on the part of the American elite towards Okinawa, Mitchell said. Most American newspapers don't report about these daily injustices to the people of Okinawa. They don't report about the contamination. They don't report about the weapons of mass destruction. To make the situation worse, the American military has dismissed the testimony of servicemen, saying they are mistaken or were lying, he said. So documents are vital.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite, Islamite. Allah my Lord, Allah my Lord. His word Quran, His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet, Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon, praise be upon. I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
By the first verse of the Holy Quran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Allah will bless you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Protect you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Help you.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
So ask His blessings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His protection.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
His help.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, other life forms. You are listening to Youth Station here on IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab.
I'm Mehdi. I'm still here.
As a person who's lived in the West, right?
Yeah, go on. Yeah.
You come from a religious family, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, never mind that.
Yeah.
But you've seen... Naturally, I'm sure you've seen people who come from non-religious families, but then they themselves as an individual have a change of heart and they become religious.
Yeah, well, we're in a place that is filled with people like these.
It really is. Know? We even have reavers. We have, like, you know, people whose families are on different religions altogether. Not that they're not practicing Muslims. They're like Catholics or Jews or Buddhists or Hindus or...
atheists,
right? Yeah. But then they become believers and they become religious and they decide to find their path toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For the longest time, and I would be lying if I say this question isn't still in my mind, I've always been wondering, how is that even possible, especially when they do it during their youth? Most of my friends that have been reverts or have repented, They did it when they were 16, 17. And then they felt like, oh my God, I need answers right now. I need to make up for all those years that I've wasted not knowing Allah. And I don't know, they decided to join the Hawza or whatever, so they could be closer to like the source, the fountainhead. How does that even happen, even?
It happens even because, well, if we want a very straightforward and small answer to that, is Yahdillahu man yasha ila salatin mustaqim. Allah guides whomever He wants to the straight path.
Yeah, but still, He doesn't do it willy-nilly.
Okay, yeah, and that has been defined for us. You know, there is a certain criteria for that, that you fit, and that happens, right? One of them being having an open conscience and questioning.
This truth-seeking thing.
Yeah, which is a part of our existence, isn't it? That we go after the truth. But like, if we... Because besides having the prophets, all the prophets that have been sent to us, and all the religions that we see around us, we have been given a prophet, right? Which, what is it? The prophet within ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Right? A conscience.
Yeah, that is a prophet.
It is.
At times we see that we are doing something and there is a completely different thought going on in our minds. And